had several questions come up. We'll talk about a couple of those first, and then we'll go into some of the, and then some of them that I've been asked have been answered. We'll talk about as we go along. Not used to talking, so my voice is running out. I have a copy here of a payment authorization that they use in Grinnell, just to give you an idea of what they use. And so I'm going to set it, if it's okay, I'll just set it here on the table. If at the break you want to come and take a look at it, you can see it's very similar to what you folks use at College Avenue, perhaps others. Very simple, but it just gives a way to communicate the information to the treasurer and make sure everything's signed off. So that's for your information. Some of you have asked about the information on the PowerPoints, and the PowerPoints are going to be posted on the yearly meeting website. So if you want to take it and share it with your stewardship committee or treasurers or whoever, you're welcome to do that. You know, maybe take my name off when you share it so that I don't get too many calls. I don't know. I don't know if I said earlier, I am not a CPA. I'm not trained as an accountant. All my training has been on. I mean, I've taken some classes and done some things, done some income tax work, things like that. Well, pretty much all my training has been on the job. That's true for farming and accounting both. But sometimes, the advantage of that, there's disadvantages to it. The advantage of that is you have to deal with it in a way that works. And so that's a little more of my tendency towards accounting. And I know most churches have somebody in the church that has a pretty good understanding of a lot of these things. If you happen to be in a situation in your church where you don't, I'm not a consultant, I don't have any credentials or any of that kind of thing, but if there's some questions that you want some help with, especially as we get into talking about how you handle some of the salaries, some of the employment forms, like I say, most people, it seems like God's kind of put somebody in every church that's got some of that background, but if you happen to be missing somebody that has that, or I can help a little bit. I don't have the definite answer on all that, but I just make that available. Another thing that came up was giving gifts of grain or stock, appreciated value gifts. I have not worked with that in the past. One of our churches said that they do have some of their farmers that are giving some grain as a way to handle that. I don't have a lot of comment about that other than to say it is very important in those types of transactions to make sure that the transfer of ownership takes place prior to the sale. In other words, if I were to take and deliver some grain to the elevator and say this goes to the Meskwaki Friends Church, then I can't go in there now that it's become their money, their grain, and sell that. Somebody from the Meskwaki Friends Church is the one that has to do that. And, the treasurer or whoever is this church would designate it. If you get into those kinds of positions, there's some advantages for some people to do that. If you get into some of those, talking with an accountant, probably the individual's accountant who's giving the money would be important, but make sure that transfer takes place, that the transfer's got to take place, or else the whole benefit of the whole thing is lost. If I still have control of it after I give it. It almost goes back a little bit to our discussion earlier. One of the things we just have to keep in mind is that when we give money to the church, it's the church's. And that's sometimes hard for us to let loose of it. I just kind of want to keep hanging on a little bit longer and make sure it goes to the right place. And it's generally more of a problem for those who are better givers, just because they recognize some of the problems that may be going on in the church and want to have something to control it. But it's a struggle that we have to work through. I've got to watch my time because I heard last night that I don't want to cross Colin and take too much of his time. I don't know what the problems are, but I know that's what Lon said, so we will keep moving. Another comment, that, and we'll t- No, we'll get that one when we come along. We're going to talk about, the other thing is liability in signing tax forms. And I don't know if I have the full answer on that. Maybe somebody else. I don't know. Chuck, do you? When the treasurer is usually the one who is designated to sign the tax forms, when you file the forms. And we're going to talk about tax forms in a little bit. But when you sign that, you have some personal liability. Is that, would you agree? Or do you know? Okay. Just want you to be aware, I believe that there is some personal liability for me as treasurer signing an employment tax form. I know it is when it happens on a corporate basis, it's still there's personal liability for the person signing it. Fraud, whatever the case might be, if the money doesn't get handled right or whatever. I just want to encourage you to do those right, because you don't want to have, I don't want to discourage you from signing them. They need to be signed. They have to be filed. But just do them right because you realize that you're on the line for them. Okay. Again, to start off, we'll look at the discipline. There it is. And see what the discipline says about the treasurer for the monthly meeting. The stewardship committee shall annually recommend to the monthly meeting a person to serve as treasurer. The appointee shall receive and dispense funds in accordance with the policy and direction of the meeting. The treasurer shall keep an accurate account of all funds in his or her care and give a complete report to monthly meeting at the close of the fiscal year. Monthly reports should also be given according to the request of the meeting. The treasurer's books shall be audited annually by a committee appointed by the monthly meeting. One person may not serve for more than 6 consecutive appointments. The treasurer shall be an ex officio member of the stewardship committee. First comment on that is just that the discipline says we should pass this around, that the treasurer shouldn't be in a position more than 6 one-year terms. And I know this is a hardship at times. There's just many churches where it's difficult to find people either willing or able, or actually you need both, willing and able to keep the books. So while it's the yearly meeting doesn't come in and say, okay, you've got to get out because you've done this for 6 years, I just encourage you to think about that. It may be something that as treasurers we need to consider. How do we train people to do that? How do we prepare the next person to come along? And that doesn't mean you can only do 1 6-year stint. I mean, you can come back around after a few years and keep trading. There's advantages and disadvantages, just like we talked about, but it's a tendency. I mean, I've heard of treasurers serving 20, 30, 40 years. In one sense, it's good. In another sense, it's not necessarily fair. To put that burden on people, there's pros and cons. We can do both ways, but there's some advantages in encouraging other people to get more involved, to understand what's going on, to develop their gifts, and it's possible as a treasurer that we can get so that we have a feeling that we want to be in charge of all the financial decisions. The longer we're there, the easier it is to do that. It just gets a little harder to hold that, coming back to the concept of steward. A steward doesn't own anything. A steward holds it with an open hand because we're managing it for somebody else. It's not ours, somebody else's. We just have to keep reminding ourselves of that and keep that perspective. Does anybody have any comments or questions about the length of a treasurer's term? I really wasn't aware that was in there until I read this, but... I don't know, and I'm sure it's been there for quite a while. But anybody have any thoughts one way or another? Okay. When we're nominating someone to be the treasurer, it sounds like stewardship. Let's see. Stewardship shall recommend to monthly meeting a person to be the treasurer. So the recommendation for treasurer comes out of stewardship, and that makes a lot of sense. You don't want to come into monthly meeting and say, okay, we need a treasurer. Who wants to volunteer? I mean, there can be some real problems with that. I mean, it might be I'd be the one to volunteer, and you know, I'm the guy in the meeting that everybody knows you can't trust. I mean, good person, just don't let me have any money. So we don't want, you know, that just puts everybody in a bad position. Oops. So if the stewardship, it's something the stewardship committee needs to take seriously, take the initiative on when it's time to change treasures, you go and you do some looking, you do some talking, and you come up with somebody who you think would be good, willing to serve. Again, the decision is made by monthly meeting, but the background work is done by the stewardship committee. Stewardship, the treasurer needs to have a basic understanding of bookkeeping. If you start talking to the person and they say, well, I don't know how to balance a checkbook, that's probably not the person you want to put in the treasurer. I mean, there's a few little questions like that you can, or I've never balanced a checkbook. I mean, you know, that, and there's a lot of people that haven't. But that's probably not the person you want in that role. They also need to be able to manage their work in a timely and accurate manner. Both are important, you know, having the report for monthly meeting on when monthly meeting meets and also having it done correctly. This is a really tough one, but it's really important, and that we talked about a little bit earlier. You know, the sensitivity that people have to people knowing what they give. The treasurer must be able to keep complete confidence about who gives money to the church. And givers demand confidentiality. I mean, we're not going to give if I know that next week everybody's going to know how much it was, whether it was good or bad. Normally the pastor does not have access to that information of who's giving what. Now, that can vary in different denominations. In other denominations, the pastor does know. But in Friends churches, we have generally not shared that. There's some advantages to that. I mean, really, being the treasurer and knowing what people give, we were just talking about that a little bit in one of the conversations I had in our break. It's kind of hard. How do you keep that from affecting your view of another person? This is the person that always stands up in the meeting and says, we ought to do this, and we ought to do that, and we ought to do that. And I know they write a check for $10 every month. I mean, how do I respond to that? It's just something that you have to be aware of. And so as treasurers, we have to be able to say, you know, I know that, but that's not something I can share. And can I keep, you know, that's an issue between them and God. And as we talked about in the morning, yeah, that may be all they're able to give because we don't know what the financial situation is going on. We don't know what needs to happen in their lives in order for them to be able to give more. They may feel like they're giving very sacrificially, and it may be because of financial situations that they're involved in. So it's not our issue to judge, but it's also not our issue to share or to deal with, either on the small side or the large side, either one. Treasurer must be able to work with the stewardship committee. It sounds like something you wouldn't have to say, but they work closely together. And so the treasurer has to be somebody that can work with the committee. The treasurer actually is ex officio member of the committee. And I have always wondered what ex officio means, so I went to the source, which is Wikipedia, and and actually looked at a few others too. But basically the idea of ex officio means by virtue of office. So you're appointed as treasurer. Because you're in that office, you are a member of a committee. And in this case, a member of the stewardship committee. Different places and different organizations, depending on their bylaws, have different views of what an ex officio committee member can do. But generally, an ex officio member has all the rights and obligations and participation requirements of any other person on the committee. But it's one that there's a line to walk there to sort through that a little bit, because sometimes there's just a lot of ways that can work. But the treasurer is expected to attend. I would say in most every situation I've seen, the treasurer is expected to attend and participate in the stewardship committee meetings, and it's very important. Because if the stewardship committee is working during the year or when they're doing the budget, either one, on things, if they don't have the treasurer there to ask the detailed questions of, they can't finish the work a lot of the time. So it just makes sense that they work together. And the Sturgeon Committee needs those reports. They need, the other piece of that, and we've been talking about what it takes to be a treasurer, but that's kind of what I mentioned earlier. As a stewardship committee, we want to keep this job from becoming too overwhelming. Sometimes we can demand too much information, we want too much detail. Let's try to run that balance and keep this. I mean, how much detail really is enough? And you know, one of the problems you get if you get too many accountants on a committee is we love detail. And we don't care about the big picture. We just want to see all the details. Well, somebody else needs to come along and say, well, okay, yeah, but let's look at the bigger picture. You know, we talked a little bit about back and forth between line item and narrative budget, and the idea that, you know, the narrative budget really makes sense for a lot of people. Well, that's not detail. That doesn't work well for accountants. We don't understand why you want to do that. So you got to keep that balance. But the stewardship committee can protect and say, you know, we don't have to have all that information. I mean, we do need this set out and this set out and this set out. Sometimes we need to check on some expenses, but we don't want to make this job into an overwhelming task. It's not a full-time position. Sometimes it's paid, but not very often or not very well, one or the other. So any other characteristics that you would add or any things that you think it's really important for qualities that a treasurer should have? Let's talk about the responsibilities of a treasurer. This would depend. Do any of the churches have a treasurer and bursar other than College Avenue? Two treasurers? Okay, like a receiving and dispersing treasurer? Okay, all right. Is that very common? Is it more than a couple? Most of the time, the treasurer does both in most churches, but occasionally it's split up. So I'll be careful how I say that as I go through this. Record all the offerings received by the church. This would be either the treasurer's responsibility or the receiving treasurer's responsibility, depending on the name that you give to that. Special, you know, you got to take up the special offerings, keep those separate, do the accounting for that so that, you know, this we took this offering up for a white gift offering at Christmas, or we took this offering up to give to the Friends Theological College in Kenya. We have to, and it, you know, it was a special offering. Everybody knew they were giving the money for that. It came out to, you know, $249.38, and we expect that money is the amount that will go to that group. And so the treasurer has to keep track of that, make sure that it comes in that way, goes out that way. I don't know if most churches do this or not. There's a different opinion, but often we will provide a report to the individuals who have given money or to the families that are given money each year, say this is the report of how much you gave. So the information needs to be recorded in a way that it can be reported. And I don't know that we're required to do that, but if someone is audited by the IRS, they may come to us and say we need to be able to prove this. And so if that's the case, then we still have to go back and do that. If we can set it up so we can do it as we go along, that's just an advantage. The other thing is, as somebody was saying, you know, Lowell was saying, you know, you look at that report when you get it, and it's about the time of year that you're doing your income tax, and so you kind of know about where you come out for the year on income and expenses. How did it come out? Did I tithe? Did I exceed my goals? All those kinds of things. There's some advantages to us as individuals to having that, and to us as a church to provide that. On the bill side, the treasurer pays all authorized bills and invoices. And that's what we talked a little bit earlier about treasurers and stewards working together to develop a system so that the treasurer knows which bills are authorized to pay, something like the voucher system that we just were talking about earlier. And then using the budget as a framework for paying those bills. Pastor's salary and benefits are all budgeted items, mileage reimbursements, health insurance, other reimbursements, as well as salary and housing allowance. Monthly meeting authorizes treasurers to pay these when it approves a budget. And probably same thing with utility bills, maintenance fees, some of those kinds of things. Just a comment that came up earlier was, it's not one of the perks of being a treasurer that you can say, yeah, I really didn't like what Pastor did on that, so I'm not going to reimburse him for this right away. That's not our decision. But it happens. It happens. We can get, our personalities get in the way. I'm just saying, that's not appropriate conduct for a treasurer. We have to keep our personalities and our personal relationship issues out of it. We do things the way they're intended to be, the way they're supposed to be. I don't pay favorably to one person quickly and the other person not because I know they give a little more and the other one doesn't, or I like them better, or any of those kinds of things. We just treat everybody with respect and dignity. Then we report annually and generally monthly to the monthly meeting, income and expenses of the church. I don't know what the pattern is. The monthly meetings I've been in generally want to report every month. Maybe some places quarterly is allowed, but normally monthly. And that report then needs to follow the categories that are established in the budget. And that's something that stewardship and treasurer can work together on, to find a report that gets the information, that doesn't take forever to put together, and gets us where we need to go so that we know what's going on in the church, we know what our expenses are, we know how we're doing on the budget. One of the things that the treasurer can bring to the report of the monthly meeting is, there's some months where there's a big expense, and it looks like all of a sudden our we were going along pretty good. We had a little bit more giving than we had expenses. We were doing that for 3 or 4 months. All of a sudden, we're $2,000 in the hole, or our giving is, or our income is $2,000 less than our expenses. Well, there may be a reason for that. A lot of times, insurance policies are paid once a year, and there's a financial benefit to that. You get a discount by doing that. But it all comes in 1 month. So the treasurer knows that. They can say, okay, when you look at this report, here's what's going on. We've accounted for this in the budget. If we continue to give as we expect to, we will be fine. You don't have to go into panic because we paid an extra $2,000 or $5,000 or whatever insurance bill was for the year, all in this month. Those are some of the benefits. Those are some of the important information that treasurers can bring. And even, if there's, I've heard treasurers say, well, yeah, our giving's a little lower now, but they've been treasurer for a little while. And they know that say, July or August tends to be a low month. And that September and October usually make it up. Well, in August, when you're given that report and everybody's starting to get a little discouraged, you say, well, here's the pattern. And you can reduce the panic. That's one of the benefits that the treasurer can have. Now, there may be times when you need panic, and that's an important thing to say too. And it really boils down. I mean, those are the really difficult times, when you get to the place where there are no reserve funds, and we have enough money to pay this. We have enough money to pay 3/4 of the bills that we have. What do we do then? Who do we not pay? And I would encourage treasurers, unless you've already gotten clear direction from the stewardship committee, I would encourage treasurers, when they get to that point, not to make that decision yourself. Oftentimes what we'll say is, well, we got to pay the utilities, we got to pay this, but the pastor can go on a little less this month, and we'll catch it up next time. I've seen that done. But is that our decision as a treasurer? My thought would be, no, it's not. That's a decision that the trustees, the stewards, and maybe the monthly meeting needs to be involved in. I certainly would not expect, if you were in that kind of position as a church, you would not want the stewardship committee to just make that decision. They may have to make a decision right now because we don't have the money to do both of them. But they need to be bringing that information to monthly meeting right away, communicating with the monthly meeting clerk. Maybe it needs a called meeting. I don't know. But we don't. And generally, as a treasurer, you see that coming. You can tell that we're getting close. So if you can give warning a month or two ahead, you don't want to always be crying wolf. But the other side of it is we do, treasurers have a better handle on where things are at than anybody else, and we have that obligation to share it. The other thing that I think is a big responsibility, and that is growing depending on staff in the church. If you have a secretary, a couple of pastors, or janitorial staff, depending on how that's all paid, there's employment and withholding tax reports and payments. And those are all the responsibility of the treasurer. And the IRS, this is something that the IRS is not forgiving on. They will quickly respond if you don't pay your employment taxes. And in fact, they'll figure them for you based on what you, if you didn't file the report, they'll figure them for you based on what you had the month before and or the report before and tell you this is how much you owe for the Social Security taxes and employment taxes for your employees. I am serving as a treasurer for Stavanger Friends Church, which is just south of La Grande. It's a church I grew up in. I don't attend there, but they couldn't find a treasurer, so I ended up doing that. And when I sent in the 941 form, we withhold taxes from the pastor's salary for income and state withholding. We don't withhold for Social Security. I mean, that's a whole different question there, but we don't. And so when you have that, you need to check a little box. There's on line 6 or 7, there's a little box that says no one is subject to Social Security in this. Well, I didn't check it. And so we got a letter real quick. I didn't know the IRS could respond that quick. I mean, like within a week or two, had a letter saying we had not paid our Social Security taxes, and they had calculated what it was because you have to enter in some numbers for salary. They calculated what it was. It was $700 and some. And, we need to pay it right away or contact them if there's a problem. So I wrote a letter and revised the form and sent it in. And pretty quick, before I thought they even could have got that letter, got another one saying, you haven't paid the taxes yet. If you haven't done it by the 10th of September or whatever it was, we're going to pull it from the checking account. And I wasn't sure I really wanted to explain all that to the board. And so I called the IRS, waited on the line for an hour and a half or whatever to get to them, found somebody that did a very good job of taking care of it and got it fixed. But little things can make a big difference. And the IRS just does not respond. I mean, employment taxes is one of the things they are just the quickest on of anything. They really hold employers to high standards. So just encourage you to take those seriously. You need to file a 941 form that goes with that when you withhold that. You need to deposit those. It used to be you could deposit at the bank. Now all the depositing is done online through EFTPS. Pretty easy to set up an account there, deposit, have it transferred out of your bank account. Fairly painless to do that. W-2 forms, 1099 forms, both need to be filed annually. Most pastors now, I think, and we can talk about this in just a minute, most pastors are getting their salary probably shown on a W-2 form. There are some that are still allowed to do the 1099, but actually Chuck Watson had talked with the IRS about some changes that were coming up we were considering, and they said people that had been reporting on the 1099 form, they were allowing them to continue, but if you made too many changes, they were going to require you to go to W-2, and anybody new needs to be starting with the income tax reported or the salary reported on W-2. So in addition to the way the pastors are reported, there's other things. Is it a 1099 or is it an employee? The secretary, most likely the secretary is an employee. The difference means if you file a W-2 form or 1099, W-2 means you're an employee. A 1099 means you're a contractor, you're a self-employed contractor. If you're a self-employed contractor, you pay the Social Security tax yourself, the 15% whatever point percent it is. If you're self-employed, the church withholds Social Security from your salary and matches that. So it and so we have to determine which are you. Lawn mowing, treasurer, those things may be contract, maybe. Cleaning can be. Secretarial work almost always would be an employee, especially if they come in and have regular hours. It's basically determined as do you, what the IRS uses is does the organization, say the church, okay, do you as a church, do you tell them what to do? Do you tell them when the hours are supposed to be? And do you, you know, do you set up the job for them and tell them when they're supposed to be there and how they're supposed to do it? And do you provide the equipment for that? If you do, you're an employee. Now, if there's flexibility in that, if you can come in and clean the church whenever you want, it just has to be done before Sunday morning, and you use, and then it's gray areas. Do you use the church's vacuum or do you bring your own? Some of those kinds of things make it a little bit of a gray area. But that would be more apt to be, you might be able to get by as a self-employed. Anyway, those have to be sorted out, and at the end of the year, you have to give the forms, the W-2s and the 1099s to the proper people. And that's the responsibility of the treasurer. Workers' compensation coverage. If you have employees, and if you have a pastor, you have employees, that should be covered under workers' comp. Required to have that, and buy it through your insurance company. It's all set based on rates. Part of what goes with workers' comp is that each year the company audits your church. What they mean by an audit is when the agent signs up your policy at the beginning of the year, that you tell them we're going to have about this much money that we're going to spend on wages and salaries, and then they come back at the end of after the year's over and they say, tell us exactly how much you spent. If there's a difference, then either up or low, up or down, you pay more. If you paid more salary than what you planned on, you pay less. Then you pay less. They give you a little bit of refund. But that has to be done, too. And you need to keep files. Don't just send an IRS report off and not keep a copy for yourself. There may be a year or two or three later that you need to prove something. And so keep those copies, have a file for that, set up a system, and not just for tax and workers' comp reports, but pretty much for all of the records you need to develop a filing system to do that. So let's stop and see if there's some questions about the responsibilities of the treasurer, comments. It's getting more complicated, and that makes it hard to get people to do the job. Yeah, Nancy. Were they insisting you cover them? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have trouble understanding how that works, because it seems to me that if you're working as a self-employed contractor, you shouldn't have to have workers' comp. But that's what I'm seeing, is that the insurance companies, the same way at the yearly meeting, they want those people covered on those policies. I think what they're looking at is they're concerned that that person may, if a person gets injured while they're doing the work, it's a limited amount of injury that we're going to have as treasurers, but if you're mowing lawn, it may not be so limited. Ron, you got a comment related to that? Yeah, and I don't quite understand that approach. It doesn't make sense to me, but... Well, then you would want... I think then you would... The insurance company is going to require you to have a certificate of insurance from them that proves that they're covered, and that's one way to do it, is to require a... I mean, it's a good general practice anyway to get a certificate of insurance from any contractor, and if it was a bigger project, you would, but what a certificate of insurance is it's their insurance company sending you a notice that this person has this type of coverage. And if it meets your requirements, you're okay. If not, you negotiate or make sure you have workers' comp on them. But it's a good question. I think you do want to cover. And the cost is fairly low, normally. Well, that's true. Yeah. And workers' comp claims are a high claim area. Yeah. Ron has a comment on that.
My understanding is that if you don't do that, you should be on a check. Good enough for IRS. That's complicated. You might have the verifications received from the government in the future. But if it's over $250, what is the effect of the future? It wants to be once a year.
Yeah, at one time it was required to be done at the time of the gift within a short time. But I think that has been modified so that you can do one notice a year. So it will make it to relieve the burden. Nancy, did you have some thoughts on that? Okay. That doesn't work. Yeah. Yeah. And Daryl. Actually, an annual, once a year. Yeah, yeah. It does? Okay. If you itemize the giving by date on the year-end report, year-end form. This is something I'm not clear about, so we may need to do some more investigating of that and find out. I know there are some specific rules on it, and we don't, you know, and it doesn't affect the church, really. It affects the individual deducting it on their tax return. That's where it becomes an issue. So, but that's going to affect the church if we make people mad and they don't want to give. So, any other thoughts, questions? Yes.
I understand the tax code to say that if you get a non-cash gift, like a borrowing gift card or item for the food pantry that exceeded $250, I had that receipt from the treasurer stating this money so that I could pay off anything like that. That's how I understood the law.
You're saying only non-cash, not cash. Yeah, and we, you know, we're going to post some of this information on the web. And I guess this kind of goes back then, you know, I was saying, you know, do you give a report from what we're talking about here of the giving to each individual member? It sounds like you better if they're going to want to be able to deduct it. So, yes, Randy.
Donor to prove the value on his or her taxes. for all that we ever gave is simply acknowledgement that we received this gift of a 1974 car. Yeah. Volkswagen bus.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And that's all.
It's not the churches or the receiving organizations' responsibility to value it. Yeah. Saying that like a Salvation Army, Goodwill, those kinds of donations. Yes. Yeah. I want to talk just a little bit about accounting software. How many of the treasurers are using software of some sort? Is there anybody that's not? So we're pretty much all doing it on what... You know, some possibilities here. QuickBooks for nonprofits, that's what's used at your meeting level. It's a double entry system. Works pretty well, but it takes some work setting it up. Quicken is used some for that. It's not a double entry system. It's only a checkbook system, meaning everything flows in and out of the checkbook. If you have non-cash transactions, that's not going to work so well. In smaller organizations, probably works fine. I have not worked with Peachtree, or I looked on the website. It looks like it's changed to Sage. Also looked on the internet. There are a lot of other software out there. Anybody have any preferences or things that you just really don't like about software one way or another that you want to share? Accounting for treasures. I only want this from treasures. Accounting software, the treasurer. Any tips you want to give on that? How many of you are using QuickBooks? And how about Quicken? And any other ones? And you saw a spreadsheet you've designed? Yeah. Does that allow you to get the reporting done that you want? One of the problems with the packaged softwares is it's difficult to get reports sometimes, and you end up putting them into a spreadsheet anyway. Those are the challenges that go with that. So, I don't have a good answer on software. I assume when you buy some of the church-specific ones, they're going to be kind of expensive. I want to talk about audit committee. The discipline says there, as we read earlier, that the financial records should be audited annually by an audit committee. When it says a committee, I assume that's more than one person, that there should actually be two or more doing that. I know sometimes it is done with one person, but I think it's important to have two people at least involved and rotate those appointments. They can be appointed by, it says they're appointed by monthly meeting. But I've sat in monthly meetings where we said, is there anybody willing to volunteer and be on the audit committee? And my preference, my recommendation is, that this is an important thing in stewardship. Let's take our responsibility here. Let's find, if the monthly meeting doesn't want to have you just suggest two, suggest a couple, three, or whatever it takes to, but suggest some people that can do the job, make sure that gets rotated. And so you come to monthly meeting with a recommendation. Here's what we recommend. Here's the people we recommend. You know ahead of time they're going to agree to do it. And you got an audit committee. The treasurer is never on the audit committee. I don't know if I need to say that, but the treasurer is not on the audit committee. that's not an option. There, we talked about being an ex officio member of the stewardship, but that didn't put him on the audit committee. That's a decision in a local meeting that would know whether that was appropriate or not. The less, I mean, in some meetings it's hard not to find a relative, but but the better we can do at making it honest, the more the better it is. Yes. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think an audit committee is a great deal for an honest treasurer. I mean, when I've worked in the corporate level, I never was sad to see the auditors come in, even though it made a lot of extra work, because I knew that by the time they left, they were telling my boss either the books were good or they weren't. If they weren't, I needed to know that. And I didn't, you know, I wanted them to be accurate and honest, and so it was a protection for me that things were done right, and that's how I think that's the way we want to look at it. It's just another way of saying, you know, I'm a steward. I'm holding this with an open hand. I'm very willing to let somebody else look at it. It talks about transparency. We talk about transparency in business some now. Transparency in government, transparency in the church means that we're not hiding these records. There's not something, no reason to give anybody a reason to think that we have something to hide. The audit process can be challenging when you look at the giving side of that, because we may not want the audit committee looking at the giving records. I think there's some ways to make that work, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But the openness is so important. I mean, we just got to have the openness that the bills that we say are being paid are being paid. So here's a procedure. I've got a little more detail on that. If you have an audit committee or you haven't had an audit committee and you want some more ideas, I've got a little more of a detailed procedure in my notes here that I could give you or send you. But we're going to go through that real quickly here before Colin gets upset. Randomly select 2 months to audit in detail. Generally, there's enough work in auditing that you can't look at all of it, but you can pick out a couple. You can look at I think you should have an audit report from the year before, so you go and look, but probably not best to do the same 2 months they did the year before, kind of mix it up a little bit, but look at it. Use the bank statement. Got to have a bank statement. It's not an audit if you haven't looked at bank statements. So this auditing committee, if the treasurer says I don't have bank statements or I don't print them out or whatever, we don't audit until we have them. That's just a requirement. And then use that in the bank reconciliation record that the treasurer print. If you're using you can either do it by hand, or if you're using software like Quicken and QuickBooks, it's easy to print out the reconciliation report, print those out, those go with the bank statement. They go to the audit committee to look at and check through. And then you look at, say, for example, check 101. That says it was written to the Salvation Army. You pick up the bank statement. You look through and see the pictures of the checks. You've got to have the pictures of the checks. If you're not getting that, you don't have a good audit trail. So if your bank isn't sending them back, you need to get them. And get it set up. I know you may have to pay a little bit of a fee, but I think it's worth it. So you look at the bank statement and you say, okay, this check was written to the Salvation Army. That's what our records show, our treasurer's records show. And then you go to the bank statement and you look and you say 101. And if that says it's written to the Salvation Army and it's for the $100, like it said in the treasurer's report, you just check it off. You know, and you keep going down through the list, go through all those things, make sure that everything was where it did. What can happen is some of those that you might not hear from that could say we wrote it to the Salvation Army, but write it to somebody else, maybe myself, as a treasurer. That's one of the ways you can steal. That's one of the advantages of the audit committee, is to to look at those things. And it's hard, you know, a profit and loss detail statement is probably what you need to print out, treasurers, for the audit committee, where it shows for the month, it shows every transaction that took place by category, or if you can't do that, at least do the check register report, some report where they can look and see everything that you said was spent and how much. The audit committee's got to have access to that in order to do that. Deposits. That's a little more of a challenge because we generally, there's two different opinions on that. Sometimes the audit committees say we don't want to, or the church says, we don't want to have the audit committee looking at the giving. We don't want them to know because now you've got the treasurer and now you've got two or three other people on the audit committee, and pretty soon you got half the church that's been looking, and you rotated that around. Pretty soon you got half the church that's been looking at the giving records, and there are no secrets anymore. So, one way to do that, if you choose not to do that, is for the people counting the money to get some records set up so that you can tell how much was cash, how much was checks, and then make sure that those total deposit amounts that were recorded by someone else other than the treasurer, if that's how you're going to check it, agree with the deposit totals that show up on the bank statement, and you kind of check down through that. That's what we mentioned earlier, where we write down the amount of each total deposit and sign off by somebody unrelated to the, not involved in counting the treasurer. It's a tricky one to sort through, but you've got to find a way to get through it. I always recommend that you examine the December detail check or the December register in detail in addition to the other two. And make sure that you check those checks that were written right at the end of the year and make sure that they got cleared the way they said they were supposed to so that there wasn't any things. So you might have to look at a couple, three different later bank statements until they've all cleared through. Checking savings and investment account balances, deposits, withdrawals. Generally, there wouldn't be very much money in and out of savings and investments unless there's, depending on how you're using them. But if there is, you need to look at them. Even if there's not, you need to see what's going on with the savings and investment accounts. This is just a little side note. We're not going to have much time to talk about it, but where do you invest money now as a church that's safe, that earns any kind of return? That's a real struggle for us right now. And cemeteries struggle with that. They're more apt to have some endowment money, and you can't get enough interest off the $100,000 that you've got invested to pay half of the mowing fees. So those are some of the challenges that we face there. And check the report of the checks that went to the treasurer, any individuals in the church, all those kinds of things. If the audit committee is unable to resolve the questions, it's their responsibility to take it to stewardship committee. They don't have to, if they can't figure it out, they take it to stewardship committee and say, somehow this doesn't seem right. Either we don't understand something or we don't know what it is, but we can't get it to work out right. So we got a question. What do we do? So you take it to stewardship committee. Stewardship committee, don't ignore it. Take a look at it. Sort it out. Again, it's that two-way street that you're working. You're protecting your treasure. You're protecting the church. And we don't want either one harmed. And the sooner if there is a problem, the sooner we correct it, find out what's going on, the better. If it gets too difficult or it's too the people involved are all your friends or relatives, it might be worth an outside accountant. I know some churches use an outside accountant regularly, but the expense gets a little bit more there, depending on even what type of audit you want. Auditing committees have been used by friends for many years. I don't know how many of you use them. I would encourage every church to use an auditing committee. We do audit all the yearly meeting books, not just the ones that are kept in the office, but all of the, like Quaker Men and USFW and Missions and Pastors Association, all of those books are audited every year by the yearly meeting audit committee. I've served on that several years, and we look very carefully at all of those and make sure that they're correct. And it's just a policy that we followed in the yearly meeting for a long time. I think it's a good thing to do. We are not going to have time to talk about pastor salary and some of those things, how you do the details of that, how you divide everything out. If those are an issue, I recommend, you want to go to WorthTac, the next one, Charlotte? I recommend, there's different opinions. I mean, you can, getting people to agree on what how to handle pastor's salary is a challenge. My preference is WorthTac service. I've been using them since 1980 as a reference. There are other sources, and you know, I don't have any fight with them or beef with them, but I just have found the WorthTac service to be one that I think does a very thorough job, and the cost is not great, $20 or so for a book each year. I know a lot of pastors buy the books. They even do pastors' tax returns, not trying to sell their services at all. I've never known anybody that had them done there. But I just they're out of Indiana. But B.J. Worth, I believe, is an enrolled agent. I think she's been doing this since 1973. Has a heart to see the churches do it right, and I think that's great. We're going to break in just a minute, but just how do you? One of the challenges we have when we come to work with the budget and the salary is how do we? What involvement does the pastor have in the budget and in the salary discussions and in the proposals of all that? Anybody have any thoughts? Anybody want to share with us what your church does? Does the ministry council determine pastor's salary? Is the pastor involved in that discussion? Is the stewardship determine it? Is the pastor involved in that discussion? Anybody have some thoughts they want to share on that? Any experiences? Good or bad? How involved is the pastor in that process?
I'm there every moment. No, I'm not involved in the process at all. I'm just the person to be evaluated. And I'm really out of the whole process. The only thing that I have to say they want to give me $1,000 raise. I might say to them, okay, I might have 500 of that designated in my professional experience. Because I'm coming short of professional.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anybody else have any comments? Yeah.
The college avenue, we usually sit down, maybe the clerk, the pastor, kind of get a feel for whether we want to go on that salary. But we divide our salary, all the salary package in the private areas. So the pastor would kind of decide how much you might want for insurance, retirement, housing, and then that eventually affects his paycheck.
Now, is the pastor part of that meeting when you're setting the salary?
Yes, in a sense that I'm for the ministry now, okay? Mm-hmm. So I've had a conference with the pastor, and we kind of talked about, you know, how you feel about this, how you feel about that. So, back to that, the worksheet makes the recommendation, which goes to the ministry and council, because the whole job, all the details, except for the flexibility.
Anybody else have anything else to add? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just a quick comment. When you're doing a books or whatever as a weekly or monthly payment, that means the pastor has to account for that on the IRS form and is treated as salary. If they submit receipts for a reimbursement, then it doesn't have to be included. And it's all a preference of the pastor and the church, but it's easier for the pastor if it's all submitted and not paid on a regular basis. But that, again, it's easier for the treasurer if you pay it regularly. So, well, I've gone through my time. We could spend another couple hours looking at pastor salary and how we handle all of that. And that maybe that will be an opportunity for someone to lead a workshop at some point in time. I think there's a lot of issues there. Again, if you're struggling with that, I think there's some people in the yearly meeting, around the yearly meeting, that could be helpful. You know, sometimes you need somebody from another church to come in and just look at things a little differently and say, well, here's what we understand. I think we should work together to help make some of those things happen. And maybe there's somebody in a church near you that could be helpful if you're struggling with that. So I will leave it at that. Well, one question, James. I agree. I don't do taxes anymore. Yeah, it's H&R Block. You might get lucky and find somebody that knew something. Even with a CPA, it can be good. In fact, probably a CPA will say either, yeah, I'll do it, or no, I won't, because they know the limitations. It is very different doing a pastor's tax return than doing a regular tax return. I would not trust it to somebody that doesn't know that. I mean, I would, and you maybe, Chuck may know who would be good. Some people like that. Ask some people in the meeting, or some other pastors in the yearly meeting here, who they're using, where they go. But I definitely agree. Oh, she just appeared on me. Definitely agree that you need to get a specialist. Well, we need to take it. Are we taking a break and then come back in a few minutes? And I'm not sure how it works.